Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Friday, October 21st, 2011. I am your host, Greg Luca, and I am joined here by a man who is using the bye week to really make a name for himself on the podcast. Is this your debut? Well, we have Mr. Booth. Let him explain. John Booth, yeah, Alligator Sports Online Editor.
This is my debut this semester. Did a little bit over the summer during the Jesse Simonton reign. But yeah, we're coming to you today with a small sports extravaganza.
Yeah, but John Booth is our small sports extraordinaire as the online guy. He reads a lot of this stuff. We've both covered a bunch of these sports, so we'll be able to bring you a lot of insight on that. And throughout the show, we have really a monster edition. We've done a lot of it. There's a chance this show could push an hour and a half. So I guess, listeners, we might have to split this into part one and part two like the pros would do it. I don't know.
I mean, you can skip around. You can keep the kids up late a couple nights in a row. And let them listen through it. So
I'll publish kind of a map, maybe, with like this minute to this minute, we'll talk about this sport. Because if you don't care about a lot of this stuff, you can at least go to the part you care about. Booth is now our men's basketball writer, so we are going to start with some of that talk. The Gators are the preseason number 10 team in the poll that came out yesterday. So what's your first reaction to that, Mr. Booth?
I wasn't surprised by the top 10 rating. I mean, I guess you look that they were number 11 coming into last year, and that was a team that was loaded with a lot of experience. They had a ton of big men. Of course, they lose that this year. They lose Chandler, who was the SEC Player of the Year, Vernon, and Alex. But you also got to look. They had a guy, Mike Rosario, from Rutgers, who's finally eligible to play. Everybody talks with, you know, it's between him and Irv, who are the best shooters on the team. And then they got a guy, Brad Beal, who's coming in as a freshman. Arguably the best recruit Billy Donovan, highest-rated recruit, I should say, that Billy Donovan's ever had. And he can also shoot the ball well too. So it's going to be a guard heavy team, and I think the number 10 rating is right about where they need to be.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me because I have a hard time seeing that this team is rated higher than last year's. But it's because last year they brought back so much stuff. There was a lot of continuity, and I feel like it's tough to really rate the teams at this point in the year because a lot of them are really reliant on freshmen, and a lot of teams this season for whatever reason just aren't bringing back as many pieces. But the thing with Florida, do you think this team is more or less talented than the unit we saw last year?
I mean, of course, that question was posed to Irving, I believe, in media last week. And he said that yes, he believes that they are more talented. But just because you have the talent doesn't mean you're going to be a more effective or a better basketball team. I mean, yeah, they might have like a little bit more NBA talent, perhaps,
right,
with Rosario and Beal as far as two guys that I could see going maybe in the first round of a draft, and whether it's next year or in a couple years. But I don't necessarily know if they're better. I do think by the end of the season, though, that they'll be a much better shooting team than they were last year. And you're not going to see like a Butler game where it just really seems like they were struggling to make any shots.
Yeah, and see, I mean, I have to go with last year's team just because they were so much more well-rounded, and you see two NBA guys in Macklin and Parsons, and obviously Parsons is the SEC Player of the Year, like you mentioned. So at this point, I have to say that that's probably the more talented team if I had to pick between the two, but it could very easily work out that this unit is just great because there's so many, like you said, there's so much talent in terms of young talent, players who could turn out to be great, guys like Beal and Rosario that we haven't seen yet.
And we don't know about Pat Young. Pat Young, like, if he makes a huge jump this year as far as in the center position, and if they get one other guy to kind of step up, I mean, if he can prove to be an effective scorer with the amount of offense that they're going to get from their guards, this could be a better team than last year's team,
right.
I feel.
I think it's a real interesting makeup of the team because you look at from last year where they lost to Butler in the Elite Eight in overtime in a game that they easily could have won and gone to the Final Four. You bring back Eric Murphy, Patrick Young, starters Irving Walker and Kenny Boynton. Billy's still here, obviously. So there's a lot of continuity. But at the same time, when you lose three big guys and the two guys that you bring in are a couple of guards, it's going to be a completely different feel. So there's a lot of people are trying to talk about how the loss to Butler is going to carry over and how they're going to build on that. But at the same time, it's like it's a completely fresh start, and that was something Billy Donovan said yesterday.
Yeah, are they even going to recognize themselves on the court from the way they played last year? I mean, I don't feel like in the early going, especially when they play Ohio State, I feel like in a couple weeks, like they're going to have to play a different brand of basketball probably. And just all of those ghosts from the past are going to go away, and they're going to have to make, you know, a new name for themselves.
Right. And then one quick news bit to touch on for anybody who hasn't been following Hoops in the offseason. It became a story in the spring, the arrest for Cody Larson and Eric Murphy. Both of those guys are fine. Nobody's serving any time. They've both been reinstated, and they're both expected to have Murphy, at least, is expected to have a big role this season. We'll have to see with Larson. But, I mean, those guys are going to be relied on just as much because, like we said, it's a guard-heavy team. And a lot of the questions from the national media about this squad are kind of how are they going to handle the chemistry building between those guys and the shot distribution with guys like, you know, Beal's a big-time scorer. Kenny and Irv took a lot of shots last year. And when Rosario was at Rutgers, he really dominated the ball. So how have you heard that that's been working out in practice so far in terms of the shot distribution with all of those players?
Yeah, I think it's going to be difficult. I mean, when you look at it, even Eric Murphy, when he gets on the court, sounds like he's most effective and deadly when it comes to shooting the long ball, to shooting a three-pointer. So that's a lot of guys, with the exception of Pat Young, who like to shoot from the outside. And it sounds like that the chemistry is working. They're all good friends. You know, of course, they're going to say that, and they all hang out. But it sounds like that they're gelling pretty well on the practice squad right now. And Billy said that the majority of touches still in practice are Patrick. He's getting his hands on the ball just about every possession, and he's taking the most amount of shots. And then you have a guy like Irving Walker, who was, I believe, second on the team in shot attempts last year. And Billy said he, along with Scotty Wilbekin, the other point guard, you know, who's gonna probably fill that role this season, they're really low to the bottom. I think he said Irving was third to last in the amount of shots taken. So it seems like there's quite a bit of unselfishness. But, you know, when the times get tough on the court, it's who are they going to go to on this team to take a shot? And they, you know, there's a lot of talk about, oh, well, we can just sub in a new person. You know, whoever has the hot hand is going to get it that night. But there's a lot of guys who, like you said, really like to be in that role as far as taking shots. When you just look at the top three guys and Kenny, Irv, and Mike, I mean, they take a lot of shots historically. So I don't know how they're going to fit into that role this season.
Right. And then another thing that stuck out to me along the line of who's taking the shots is that they still want to run the offense inside out, from what Billy said on Media Day. I mean, we'll talk about a lot more about a lot of these things, and this specifically how we kind of see the offense going when we do a basketball preview podcast. With this, we're kind of just trying to touch on a lot of the things that came out at Media Day. But, I mean, what was your reaction to that kind of statement, that they're still trying to go inside out?
Yeah, I think it's a noble effort. And I think if you're able to do that against some teams, by all means, you know, I think that's the way basketball should be played, especially towards the beginning of the game in a more traditional sense. But how is that going to be possible in this, you know, kind of hyper, you know, attack four guard set that they're talking about? I don't really see how they can be effective in that way. I mean, if they're able to, if another guy is able to step up in the power forward position, perhaps, you know, a Larson, you get Murphy kind of role and go in there, by all means, I think they'll be able to do that, just because it'll take a body away from Pat.
Right.
But I think against the better teams that they're going to play, and there's a lot of them that they're going to play early in the non-conference, I don't see how that's possible.
Right, especially because none of those low-post guys are, like, low-post scorers, especially Patrick Young. That's not his game.
Patrick, you know, even if he makes a jump this season, I mean, with 10 points a game, would that be a big deal if he scored that, you think?
Right, like, it depends how they come, because I think for them to run the offense efficiently, they'd like to have the situation where he can post up and they throw him the ball and he needs to be double teamed.
Yeah.
Like he's got a hook shot or something that he can do, like what Macklin did last year to really draw attention away. Mm-hmm. If he can't do that, it doesn't really matter how many points he scores if he's not getting the attention for the team to kind of open things up.
A facilitator, if he's just distributing from the block, I mean, that's really not going to do much to a defense.
One quick thing then on Patrick that jumped out to me is, a lot was made last year and the year before that and the year before that with guys like him and Vernon Macklin and some of the other big bodies they've had in practice. The benefit that comes with those guys being able to work against each other. When I look at this year's roster, I don't see a guy that can physically challenge Patrick Young and push him in practice. And they've talked a little bit about kind of things they've tried to do to him. What have they said on that front? And do you see a guy that can kind of push him the way he might need to be pushed?
Yeah, I mean, what were they saying? That they were scratching and clawing at him at practice. He was getting hacked up. Nobody could really match up with him in a way that he would actually see in a basketball game where somebody's playing good, sound defense against him. He's just getting hacked. And you know, what is that going to do when somebody's able to match him, like a Sullinger or a Festus Ezeli or something
right.
like that? So, but as far as a guy who can challenge him in practice, I mean, he said a guy like Will Yeguet, who is lengthy and he is a very athletic guy, he said that he matches up with him the best. Heard some things about Cody Larson. He seems like a pretty strong guy who can at least body up to him, maybe when they're both going up for a rebound or something. But I don't see, you know, if Patrick Young's backing somebody up, I don't see anybody on the team with the strength to be able to handle him without hacking him.
Yeah, those are certain types of challenges, but I don't see, like, the big body that can really make it difficult for him to rebound in practice. So we'll see if that carries over.
And last year, you would think that when he and Macklin were going against each other in practice, that would have been a pretty good battle.
Yeah, a couple things I want to touch on that were said. A couple of them are really obvious, like Billy wants Irving Walker to lead the league in assists. That's something that is going to be a focus for him with so many talented scorers around him. Mike Rosario is excited to play, shocker of all shockers, after sitting out for the year. But one thing that I did think was actually interesting in terms of the way they responded to our questions was Brad Beal and how he's kind of come in. Talk about what you heard on that front from the players and from Billy about his attitude so far.
Yeah, I think they're definitely surprised. A lot of the players were when Beal first came in that he really took a backseat role to them. He really deferred to them in kind of the first practices and even when they were training early in the preseason. I'm sure a guy like Kenny Boydton or Irving Walker, you know, they see this big five-star guy, one of the top recruits that Billy Donovan's ever had, highest-rated guard he's ever had. And they probably weren't worried about their job, but they were just probably worried about the chemistry being broken up between them after playing together for so long. But yeah, Billy Donovan said this is the most mature freshman that he's maybe ever had. Kenny Boynton says he's just about best friend he has already on the team,
which is weird because Irv and Kenny are supposed to be best buds.
Yeah, they're so tight. But Kenny said they go everywhere together. They eat together. They study together. They go to the mall together. I mean, it sounds like he's immediately gelled with that backcourt, which is something they need. I mean, when you're already adding a guy like Rosario, who does like to shoot, who does like to score, but he has been here a year, you know, and so everybody does know him, and now you're adding another guy, you need that kind of, you know, that guy who's not going to come in with that alpha personality in
right.
the backcourt. And it sounds like that's what he's going to do. He's been playing well on defense, it sounds like. We haven't really heard too much as far as how his shooting is in practice, whether he's really knocking down the shots, but everybody's saying that, yeah, he has great range. His shot is looking good. So they're going to look for a little bit probably more out of him defensively than normally you would a freshman guard, just because he is going to be a bigger guy.
Yeah, and he's been playing some at the three in practice, apparently.
Three, yeah, he's 6'3". I can't remember exactly what he weighs, maybe 220 or so.
I remember that they said that he put on a decent amount of weight,
yeah,
like over the summer and since he's been here even.
Yeah, so he's put on a little bit of weight, so he'll probably be asked to take on the other team's biggest guard, maybe defensively. So it looks like he'll have a substantial role off the bat for Florida this year.
Yeah, we'll talk more about kind of how we think the guard situation is going to shake out, where the minutes are going to go, where the shots are going to go when we get into more of our preview podcast. But one thing I want to touch on as it relates to media day is we talked a little bit about what these guys were up to over the summer. A couple people stayed around for the summer sessions. Obviously, Larson and Murphy had their own struggles.
Yeah,
but guys that were interesting to me were Will Yeguet and Patrick Young. Why don't you talk a little bit about what they were up to this offseason?
Yeah, Will and Patrick both went overseas. Patrick played for the United States U-20 national team. And Will, who's a Bordeaux, France native, played for the French U-20 team in the FIBA European Championships. And sounds like both of them had successful summers. You know, it's good experience, especially for Will, a guy who really didn't get to play that much last year, to really step into a larger role on a team for a couple weeks and be looked on, I guess, maybe not as the guy. I mean, He averaged a team-leading about 6 points and six rebounds, which you look at that, you're like, oh, that's not very
right,
high.
That's whatever,
or,
but...
Yeah, the team must not have been very good. But they had a, they had a high finish in the European Championships. They played 9 games. I believe they only lost one.
Wow, okay.
So they had a good run during that, and Will said it was really a focus this summer for him to improve offensively a little bit. It didn't sound like he was able to get that one move like a guy like Macklin did, where it's, you know, a hook shot or anything like that. But if he can just be a more efficient scorer
right.
for them, you know,
be
that
a
would,
scorer for
yeah,
them, yeah,
be a scorer to a guy that's not going to blow a shot
right.
you know, when he does get an open opportunity. But and then Patrick on the U.S. side, you know, again, I believe this is his second summer playing with the team. They came up short again, but it was really impressive to hear that he took the loss hard. You know, that it's not just him wanting to kind of go through the motions during the summer. Oh, I get to play for the U.S. It'll keep me in shape. But that he was actually out there competing hard, and he had another successful summer.
Right. They took home the bronze, right?
Yeah, they took home the bronze. So they did come up short, and, you know, it's nice to hear that he was at least disappointed by the result.
Right. All right, so I think that about wraps up the basketball talk. I think Booth and I could go for, like, hours on
yeah.
the hoops team at this point. But we'll save that for a little later on as we get through some of the exhibition games and get closer to the season. And then, obviously, once the season starts, we'll be talking about that a lot. But for right now, we're going to shift our focus to some of the smaller sports. The guests are going to come fast and furious. We're going to hit some of these in depth. We're going to hit some of these real quick. But we're gonna touch on pretty much every sport going on at UF right now. So fasten your seatbelts, listener. It's going to be a wild ride. All right, we're going to move into the soccer portion of the Small Sports Podcast. We have Booth here, who was on soccer earlier this year before we made the transition over to basketball. And we are also joined by first-time podcast guest, I think, Josh Jernovoy.
Yes, I'm excited to be here. This is the first time that you guys are actually interviewing me rather than the other way around.
Yeah, Josh is our he's a alligator writer slash resident radio host, so maybe we should get him in here a little more often. He's got some experience. But for now, we're just going to get you started nice and easy. Just talk a little bit about the soccer team, where they stand in the SEC and nationally.
Oh, right now, they're tied with a few other teams in the SEC East. They still control their own destiny. They have a 6-2 conference record. They're 13-4 overall, ranked number 13th in the country, coming off a very disappointing loss to Mississippi State on Sunday, where they gave up a goal in 37 seconds into the game, and then ended up outshooting Mississippi State 24-13 the rest of the way, and really controlled the ball and just couldn't get a goal in there. So they're coming off of that. Despite that loss, though, all they have to do is win the remaining SEC games, and they'll win the conference going into the SEC tournament in Orange Beach.
Who are some of the other contenders in the SEC? Who are the guys to watch out for?
Well, LSU, that's the big game they have coming up Sunday. They play Arkansas tonight. That shouldn't be trouble for them, although that's what they thought on Sunday. But they got LSU coming up on next Sunday, and they're tied with Florida at the top of the SEC, so even though they're in the West. In the East, they still have to worry about Georgia, LSU, South Carolina, or Georgia and South Carolina, rather. Georgia, they already played, and they beat them. And they got South Carolina on their last regular season game a week from tomorrow.
I don't know if you're in the business of predictions, but where do you see them shaking out in the SEC? Do you think they can kind of work their way through that field?
Yeah, I think they can easily win these next few games. It wouldn't surprise me if they lost. It wouldn't surprise me if they lost any game because this team has shown a lot of inconsistency. But I think they'll beat Arkansas tonight. I think they'll beat LSU at home that senior day. I think they'll have some good mojo going for that. And then last Friday of the season, they're also at home against South Carolina. And I'll keep picking them at home, but it wouldn't shock me to see them drop one of those.
Have they been bad on the road this year? Is that something that's kind of a trend? Or?
Well, they lost a neutral site game to UCLA. That was a tough loss for them, and they lost in Starkville when they played Mississippi State. Their other losses were they had one at home to Florida State, and who's their other loss?
They had Tennessee away.
Tennessee was away also. So they've only dropped one game at home, and I mean, this is probably a little... At this point in the season, they're usually doing better than this, but it's not like they have a terrible road record, but that's where they have dropped more of their games, either at neutral sites or on the road.
All right. Mr. Booth, from what you know about the soccer team, how do you see them shaking out in the SEC with a few games left here?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a possibility that they could run the table these last few games. And yeah, winning an SEC regular season title, that's a pretty impressive accomplishment. But they're still going to have to worry about playing in the tournament. I think we talked a little while ago. They have a really good RPI right now, really strong, number five. So if they just keep on this trend where they can win three out of the next four, so to speak, and then maybe win the SEC championship in the tournament, they're going to have a very, very strong chance at being a number one overall seed or two seed or something like that.
Yeah, they played a tough enough schedule and done well enough against it. They'll be hosting that second weekend in November. The first round of the NCAA tournament, they will be here.
Yeah, yeah, and you have to look at, they have one really bad loss, and that is that Tennessee loss on the road just because they went down by so much. They did rally, though. I think them being able to actually score a couple goals in that game will help kind of their chances, even though they had four scored against
them. That was a bad loss for how they get up the goals, but they had another really, really bad loss in that Mississippi State game, though.
Yeah, that's true. But that's still a low-scoring affair in conference on the road after they won a couple days earlier. I think, you know, those looking at the tournament committee or whatever it's going to be are going to be a little bit more forgiving for that being it's the second game.
Now, I don't know a lot about the NCAA soccer tournament, and I'm not sure how much our listeners know. How many teams make the field? Kind of how does that work? Break that down for me a little bit.
It's about 34, I believe. It's a pretty strong field usually. I mean, you're going to see the ACC powers. You know, they're going to be a lot of the top seeds. Florida's going to have a chance. You know, LSU really hasn't played the same sort of schedule that Florida has this year, so they're a little unproven. You know, they don't have the RPI, they don't have the ranking of Florida right now because of that, but certainly they've been impressive. They've been just as impressive in conference as Florida has, so you got to think that they're a good team. I think the reason why Florida's struggling right now, especially with the finishing, with, you know, like Josh said, they're out shooting their opponents pretty much every single game. But the reason why they're struggling is it's because it's freshmen who are playing up top and who are having to finish these shots along with a player like Erica Timrat.
Right. I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with kind of the recent history of Florida soccer, but when you look at Coach Becky Burley, actually, you know, you can talk a little bit about her and kind of how her style and what she brings to the table, but also just her history kind of in the tournament or in postseason play, how they've kind of done historically.
Well, They've always had enough success in the regular season to make the tournament. She's been here for 17 years. They've won one national championship, though. That was in 1996, I believe. Or no, 98. Yeah, they won the national championship in
Abby Wambach.
1998. Team. They had the team with Abby Wambach, and they had a lot of success that year. And they've always been around. I think it's almost very similar to Gator Volleyball. Although Gator Volleyball hasn't won a national championship, they always make it to the tournament. It's just been a matter of not necessarily being able to win more than one national championship, despite the fact they have been a solid team during her tenure here.
And it's a very young sport still. I believe it's only been around since the mid-90s.
Since she's been here.
Yeah, since she's been here, really, that this tournament has been around. And even then, it was even smaller than it is today. So that was really, you know, that was quite an accomplishment for her to get it so early, because North Carolina was the dominant team in those first couple years.
Talk a little bit about her style of coaching as much as you can, just based on what, do they play fast? Are they more of a pressure team? They sit back more so? What's her forte as far as that goes? What do you see when you watch Florida soccer?
They're extremely, you know, high concentrated passes. They don't like to pass back a lot. They don't really like to work it around. They want to get forward. They want to get down the field. They really want to use their wingers, their top two on their back line, their two outside backers like to push up a lot, and that's a player like Jasmine Avant or Maggie Rogers, and they really like to go all forward and keep the ball in the other team's half.
They do like to press a lot, and they rely on quick passing a lot. They like to call it 1-2 touch. I wouldn't say they like to push it up a lot, but they're not necessarily the most aggressive team once they get there. A lot of what we've seen that's been part of the reason for their finishing troubles lately is they like to pass almost too much sometimes. Mm-hmm. They like to look for that perfect shot, and sometimes they'll look for it too long, and that scoring chance will pass them by. And they're also not the most aggressive team when it comes to set pieces. Throughout the season, at times we've seen them just kind of pass it off whenever they get a free kick or a corner kick, and other times they have been aggressive and have found success doing it. But in some instances, I would say they are, like John said, very aggressive pushing the ball up the field, but not necessarily the most aggressive team once they get inside the 18.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they definitely want high percentage chances, it feels like. And the set pieces are, it's a little frustrating to watch sometimes because they are a very tall team compared to a lot of teams that they do play, especially in the midfield. So when you see this height advantage, especially on corner kicks, and they're not necessarily using it by firing the ball into the box, you're kind of like, okay, what are they doing? But then again, when you have a player like Erica Timrat, who's probably going to be in the running for SEC Player of the Year, I think, at this point, the way she can create just with the ball by herself, you know, you gotta you got to think that that is, that could be an effective way to score even without sending the ball in.
Talking about Erica Timrak, this is the number 15 offense in college soccer. They score about 2.5 goals a game, and Erica Timrak is the leading scorer with 11 goals on the season. Josh, what makes her a special player? Why is she so effective?
Well, part of it is her on-the-ball skills. She's a very technical player. She's very fun to watch dribble. She can really dribble around almost anyone on the other team, and she has a great shot. We've seen her multiple times. Just if she gets an open look from the top of the 18, she'll just let it rip sometimes, and she's found the back of the net several times on just shots like that from 18, 20 yards out. And she has a very good shot like that, but she also has very great vision. She has numerous assists also. She's good at finding her teammates. She's just a very all-around solid player, and she's having a breakout year. The 11 goals she has on the season, that's matched what she had coming into the season for her entire career. Only had, I think, 5 goals her freshman season, 6 her sophomore season. So it's really been a breakout year for her.
Yeah, it's definitely been an emergence for her. I mean, she played on the U20 women's team this summer over in Sweden. So that was definitely, you know, a big experience for her. And it's kind of amazing, yeah, that she's taken the forefront in scoring when she was so much a facilitator last year with Tana Annis and Mackenzie Barney, who are still on the team but aren't having quite the scoring years that they had last year.
Who are some of the other offensive standouts that you guys have seen so far in terms of skills or production or however you want to rank them?
The next player you'd want to talk about would probably be Annie Spies, a freshman. She's from Georgia. She was actually committed to Georgia before they had a coaching change and came into Florida pretty late in the recruiting process. And she's just kind of been very impressive. She's had a couple multi-goal games, one against Alabama just a couple weeks ago. And she's just a very impressive player, similar to Timmer, actually. Great shooting ability and great vision on the field. She just, in that game against Alabama, she lined up for a free kick from just outside the box and just drilled it right into the top right corner. She has a great shot also, and she's just a player that really, everyone speaks very highly of her soccer IQ, because she's kind of, it's impressive for a player to come in at that young of an age and just look that comfortable on the field in such a high level of play.
Yeah, that Alabama shot really showed a lot of her, I think, maturity and kind of confidence in her play. I mean, that keeper, she played on Canada's national team just a few months ago, you know, that played against the United States, you know, World Cup final team. So, yeah, for her to have the confidence to shoot that shot and make it pretty close to the end of the game, that really spoke a lot about her. And I think, you know, over the next couple of years, she is going to, you know, she has the potential to be just as great as Erica Timrak is, I think, and have a future on the U.S. team.
Is she a freshman or a sophomore?
Yeah, she's a freshman, and she's really, I mean, the way that she's scoring the ball right now, you know, multi-goal games, that's not something that Erica was really doing as a freshman.
Yeah, and she didn't do that until this year.
Yeah, and you know, just being the second most effective scorer as a freshman with a team that is pretty loaded in the midfield and forward, we see a lot of substitutions in this team, and she's really become a key cog in that, and a player you can't leave off the field.
Are there any other young players looking ahead to the future that are kind of the young talent that's going to carry Florida soccer forward in the next couple of years?
Definitely. Havana Salon, actually, my article in the Alligator today was about her. She's the third leading scorer on the team right after Spies. She has 5 goals and 6 assists on the season. She actually scored a goal in her first game as a Gator against Miami, and she's just kind of broke onto the scene. And one of the funny things about her is that they've kind of used her as a weapon off the bench. She usually comes in probably between the 20th and 30th minute, and she's really been effective in that role, coming in at midfield. But she's a player who she's probably is one of their better finishers. One of the funnier stats I saw when just looking at it, 11 shots on the season, 5 goals, which is a crazy percentage. It shows that when she gets the opportunity, she really, really just goes for it, and she takes it. And one of the things that Burley said about her that was very interesting is that she's someone that doesn't panic. So when she gets the ball, she's not necessarily just going to – if passing is the best option, she's going to do that. And she's not going to panic and take a bad shot. And that's probably one of the reasons why she has such a high percentage of goals, considering the few amount of shots she's taken. Only 11 shots on the entire season. They played 17 games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she's definitely a tough player, you know, to start at the beginning of the game, just because it seemed like she is kind of as strong as she goes straight into the action. She's not afraid to attack, and definitely that's not something that you want at the beginning of the game when you're just trying to feel things out. But definitely in her role off the bench, she is incredibly effective. She had a little bit of a lull there, it seemed like, after her big first game against Miami, but definitely lately it feels like every week it's a new freshman that's, you know, that's having a huge game for Florida.
She's also a Gainesville native. She went to Buchholz. Her teammate from high school, Kim Sapien, is also a freshman on the team. She hasn't seen as much playing time this year, but just very good, very unusual for the Gators to have a local player come in and just have this kind of success off the bat. And for a player to have the kind of maturity they say she has and have that kind of calmness on the field, something you don't often see in freshmen.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about the offense. Moving over to the defensive side a little bit, they kind of ranked in the 80s nationally, I saw, giving up about a goal a game. Is that a problem area for them, or is it just average? What do you guys see as far as the defense goes?
I mean, definitely a problem arose a couple weeks ago when Katie Cadera, who's a kind of first-time starter this season, has battled through a ton of injury problems with her ACL, but she was having a great season. She went down with another ACL injury.
She's just a defender?
Yeah, she's a defender. On the back line, she kind of plays in the center back position along with Kat Williamson, who's probably the best defender in the SEC. She's a player that has a little bit of national team experience and some training camps and has been numerous SEC Defender of the Week awards this year. But yeah, defensively, they've had to work in a freshman there as a starter, Annie Bobbitt. They really don't have anybody that they can sub in back there on the back line. And that's a problem that Becky Broly kind of talked about a couple weeks ago, that, you know, they're incredibly thin there, whereas they did have a good rotation. And we've seen a couple times in these games where Bobbitt has had some turnovers, notably in the Auburn game, that have led to, like, really, really tough goals for the Gators to stomach.
They've been very inconsistent. They had that Tennessee game where that was even when Kandera was still in, and they had a couple turnovers along the back line, and that kind of cost them in that one. They gave up those goals. But going forward, I'd say that the depth has become somewhat of an issue. Kat Williamson plays almost the full 90 every game, and that's not unusual. She was doing that before they had the injuries. She's really the anchor of the defense, and that's pretty common for that position. But just they don't have a whole lot of depth along there. Like John was talking about earlier, their outside backs, who are, in my opinion, probably the two most fun players to watch on the team, and Jasmine Avant and Maggie Rogers, just, they ask them to play all over the field. You'll see them making runs, and at times they'll be playing ahead of any forward on the team. But then they got to get back on defense. That's a position where it's not typical for them to play the full 90 because they're asked to just run all over the field. It's probably the most taxing position on the field, and they don't really have anyone that's anywhere near the level of those two to sub in for them. And there's also the inconsistency issue they have since Cadera went down, but they have had some very good games and they've had some very down games, so going forward that might be the key.
Yeah, and it's tough to say that they need to sub anybody in on that back line, being that Kat Williamson should never leave the field. You know, in these blowout games, it's kind of like, wow, okay, she's the one starter that's still out there no matter what. Becky can't take her out, but I can't imagine the team not having Jasmine and Maggie working the wings. You know, they just bring such a key dynamic to that offense that I don't see, you know, how they could play the same style without them.
Aside from depth and turnovers, is there a defensive issue you guys can see tactically that's kind of made them not as great as they could be, or is it just those two things, really?
I mean, they play such a high line every single game. I mean, they really...
Which is, like, the defense pushing forward?
Yeah, it's the defense pushing forward. I mean, it's Bobbitt and Kat pretty much at midfield. At midfield, trying to be the stopgaps to kind of prevent the counterattack. And we've only seen that exposed a couple times, really. You don't really see a lot of fast breaks happen against Florida in transition.
That fourth goal in the Tennessee game, that was a product of that. One of them got kind of behind them, not offsides, but one of them was able to kind of receive a pass and just get behind them because the center backs were playing so far up. But for the most part, like you said, it's mainly been those turnovers and some of the general inconsistency.
They were really pressing at that point, though. They needed a goal to tie it up, so that was more a product of them being a little bit more risky than they would normally be.
All right, and the only thing we haven't touched on yet is the goalies. I know earlier in the year there was kind of a two-goalie system where they were cycling people in and out. Has that sort of shaken itself out as we've gone along here?
Yeah, I think the two-goalie system is it's about run its course, I think, at this point. I think Taylor Burke, the freshman, incredibly athletic player. She's about 6 foot to 6 foot one. Won a bunch of high school, you know, awards. I think she was a Gatorade Player of the Year. She can jump. I believe she can jump over 6 foot in the high jump.
She's going to do high jump.
Yeah, she's going to be a high jumper for the Gators as well in the spring. So she's incredibly athletic, but she is raw. She is young. So early in the season, they tried to work in Brooke Chansey, a player that's played behind Katie Frayne her entire career. And, you know, of course, with Katie Frayne leaving this summer, Brooke thought she'd have a chance to come in and win the starting job for good. But she's a little bit smaller, a little less athletic than Taylor. And she's been exposed in a couple games because of that, because she doesn't have the wingspan and teams can just pull it past her.
And one of the interesting things about that dynamic, like you said, Brooke is a high jumper. She's 6'1". Chancey's just 5'6". And one of the biggest things I've noticed from that is that when, like, someone sends a corner kick in, Brooke has the ability to just kind of jump up and catch that. Chancey does not have that length. Often what she tries to do is she just tries to punch the ball out.
Yeah.
One of the goals they gave up, I can't remember which game it was. It was just a matter of her missing it when she punched it, and they headed it in. And it's just,
that was the Alabama game.
Oh, that first goal in the Alabama game where Alabama jumped out to the lead. That's where that came from. And it's just so many fewer loose balls when Burke is in net, because she can just get her hands on that and jump up and jump just about taller. She's taller than any forward on any other team. She can just jump over them, and because of her wingspan, having the 7 inches on her.
Yeah, and they had Brooke start in the Alabama game, and you kind of see a trend where
She came out at halftime.
At the beginning of the season, it was, okay, Brooke will play the tough games, and Taylor will play kind of like the easier opponents, the easier. And now you've seen that change. Now it's, okay, Taylor's going to play the big games, and Brooke will get some time in the easier games, kind of to spell Taylor, maybe, you know, rest her mentally a little bit. But, yeah, that's completely changed. In the Alabama game, they had to sub out the goalies at halftime. That's the first time we've seen that this season. So I think we're going to see a lot of Taylor Burke for the rest of the season.
Very solid. All right, we've gone pretty thorough in our soccer coverage, but is there any names we haven't mentioned that you guys feel we need to get a shout-out to? I feel like I've heard a lot about Tane Annis. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think we've talked about her a lot. She's a name I hear a lot. What does she bring to the table?
Yeah, Tane is definitely one of the more experienced strikers on the team. She certainly has the ability to score. Kind of with the emergence of these freshmen and the high number of substitutions that they're using this year, both Tane and McKenzie, who were the leading scorers on the team last year, kind of seen their roles taken back. They don't have that responsibility of needing to score, but they have scored a couple huge goals this season. You know, Tane has put in some significant minutes, and Barney has had 2 game winners.
That's
this
the one
season.
I was going to say. Yeah, honestly, she's. I'd say her playing time, that's probably gone down a little bit with the emergence of the freshman.
Yeah, it's
same with Barney. But Barney's definitely the other player I would mention because of those big goals. She had the golden goal against Texas A&M towards the beginning of the season, and just earlier she had that one against Auburn. So while their playing time's gone down, they still contributed in significant ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're still in the top 5 in scoring on the team. So, you know, it's not like they're having horrific years. It's just a combination of Erica Timmerack having, you know, a stellar career year and these freshmen actually contributing to the team.
All right, so to kind of wrap this up, I want to get a prediction from each of you where Florida soccer finishes in the SEC and then nationally this season. If you guys had to pick right now, make a guess for me. Start Booth, what do you got for me?
If I had to pick right now, I think with LSU and South Carolina at home, I think they do win both of those games and are the SEC regular season champions. I don't think they make it all the way through the SEC tournament. I think at this point in the season, you'd want them to be able to put away a team like Mississippi State. And I think one of the better teams, if they have to play a Tennessee again, if they have to play LSU twice, I think somebody is going to get them in the SEC tournament before they even make it to the final. And nationally, I mean, this team's lost in the second round the last 2 years. I don't think this team at the moment is any better than either of those two teams. I can't pick them past that. I mean, I'm not going to pick them to go into the Elite Eight or Final Four, or certainly the national championship game, despite what their RPI might say. In every big game that they've played this season against a top 25 opponent, it feels like they've lost or come up short in non-conference games.
I agree with John. I didn't see them. Nothing would surprise me with this team at this point because they are very, very talented, but they just haven't shown the consistency that would warrant being picked going any farther than the second round of the NCAA tournament.
Yeah.
I do think with those home games, I think they'll run the table these next 3 games. And in the SEC tournament, I just don't think they've shown the ability to beat the good teams or even the bad teams that they should beat consistently enough to win that thing, go all the way through it in Orange Beach. So I think they'll win these next few games, and I think they could win a couple games in the SEC but not win the whole thing, just like John said. And I think they get through the first round of the NCAA tournament at home, but I just don't think they're good enough yet. They haven't shown it at this point in the season to get past the second round.
They still are young, though. I mean, they have a lot of redshirt juniors. Yeah, who are going to be, you know, fifth-year seniors.
They're not losing
on that
a whole
team.
Lot.
So next year they are going to be an incredibly scary soccer team. I think they definitely that's probably a little bit more of the target year. Probably Becky Burley's thinking with how many freshmen they are playing this season.
All right, so maybe this isn't the year for Florida soccer, but in the future, look out, guys. All right, very nice job today, you two. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to shift over to the volleyball portion of the show. To talk about that, we've welcomed in beat writer Brian Holt. Say what's up.
Howdy.
And we have former beat writer who switched over to Whoops, but he should still remember some of this stuff. We have Joe Morgan.
How's it going?
Traitor.
All right, so Mr. Holt, you can start us off. Just give me a kind of a breakdown of where the team is nationally and in the SEC, how they're doing this year so far.
The team's ranked number 13 in the country right now. They're on their hottest streak of the season. They're on their hottest streak in 2 years, actually, right now. They won 7 games in a row, all straight six victories. They had a big pick-me-up, you know, last week when Kentucky beat Tennessee. It was kind of, you know, everybody was chasing Tennessee for a little while, and now it's where Florida controls their own destiny. They got Mississippi State coming up on Sunday, and then next weekend they're going into, you know, their biggest weekend of the year. It's going to be Kentucky and Tennessee on the road. It's basically going to be for the SEC championship. So, yeah, I mean, they're hoping to keep, obviously, what they're doing right now going, but the competition's obviously about to step up a little bit.
All right, and the big story with the volleyball team every year seems to be that they have such a good team, and then they get to the tournament, and then they don't end up winning. What, I mean, is there anything about this year's team that makes you think this could be the year that they finally break through?
I'm not sure if I personally feel that way. I know the way that they feel right now is that the problem they have in the postseason a lot of years is backcourt defense, that they don't feel like – they always have a very strong front court. They always are leading the conference in, you know, blocks and kills and hitting percentage and all those kind of things. But it's not something that, you know, makes them complete enough to really compete once they get to, you know, the final 16 teams, the regional finals, things like that. And this year, I mean, they feel like the backcourt's stronger. I still, and you know, it's very young. They have, you know, 3 defensive specialists who do contribute, and they're all freshmen. So, you know, their libero is a freshman. And, you know, maybe, like, I know Mary Wise, the head coach, thinks that she is a lot more talented than the libero they've had, you know, since probably at least Cusack. But, I mean, it's just going to be a matter of seeing how they kind of mature at that time of the year, especially in the backcourt. And, you know, where they're at right now, they're playing a lot better already than they were at the beginning of the year. So there's a lot of kind of telling things there, but, you know, it's all going to depend on how they kind of respond to that time of year.
Joe, do you see this as a year they could potentially break through?
I don't think so. When Brian was talking about the backcourt play, they're just really young. They're streaky. I mean, like, Unroh can be really, really good at times, but she can also have her spells like she did against Georgia and Auburn a couple weeks back. So, I mean, I don't see enough consistency back there to think that they're going to make a push with this particular version of this team.
Talking about some of the individual players, last year the best player, first-team All-American, was a favorite of mine, Kelly Murphy. Why don't you guys talk a little bit about what she's done this year, what she's brought to the team so far.
You got her Facebook up over there?
No.
Okay.
Right. Still haven't been accepted yet. Kelly, if you're listening. Greg Luca.
Purgatory, man. Purgatory. Kelly is, I mean, probably one of the most well-rounded players in volleyball. I know, you know, Mary Wise likes to call her the busiest player in college volleyball because she does so many different things for this team. She's, you know, making digs, setting, getting kills when she needs to, and, you know, keep being competitive with the kill numbers that she has, even though she has half the attempts that all the other outside hitters and things like that have. So, you know, really it's tough to judge sometimes because everybody else has one stat that's really amped up, but Kelly is just kind of, you know, that way across the board, getting a lot of triple doubles and things like that. There were actually, you know, a couple weeks where Mary Wise did talk her down a little bit and said, you know, she's not playing up to her potential right now. She's not doing some of the things she should be doing. She was making a lot of errors for a little while and things like that, but it seems like she's kind of rounding that back out and, you know, getting to a point where she is being, you know, very, very consistent and keeping things going and, you know, setting up all the other players and doing the things she needs to do.
Yeah, on offense this year, you have a lot of great individual, like Betsy Smith's having a terrific year in terms of kill numbers, hitting efficiency, Jay Cole, Stephanie Farrell. Murphy's just kind of taking a back seat to that because, I mean, she's making it possible for those players to step up. A lot of Coach Wise mentioned a lot of players key in on her so she doesn't get as many attempts. But, I mean, Kelly Murphy's definitely the reason why Smith, Jekyll, Farrell, et cetera, are having such high efficiency numbers because she constantly getting a lot of assists, constantly doing your part, multiple aspects of the game. So yeah. Kelly Murphy really is the cog that keeps his team going. And I think without her, that, you know, you see a completely different team.
I think Betsy Smith has been one of – has really benefited from, you know, the balanced play of Kelly Murphy this year. You know, she's a player who's played behind people in the past and not really had gotten a chance to put up big numbers. And just with, you know, all the different roles that Kelly Murphy takes on, it gives her more of a chance to come in and get some of the swings for kills and things like that. And she's, you know, done a very good job of it. She doesn't get a whole – she doesn't get many rotations. She doesn't get a whole lot of swings, but she has the highest hitting efficiency in the SEC. You know, just this past game, she had 11 swings and 10 kills. So, you know, she's definitely taking advantage of what she's getting, and a lot of that comes from Kelly Murphy being able to, you know, make that front court that much better.
Now, you guys mentioned Christy Jakel real quick. She leads the team in total attacks, and she leads the team in kills by a pretty wide margin. How heavily do they kind of rely on her to produce a lot of points that way for them?
They completely rely on her offensively, especially. She's kind of, you know, the spark plug to get things going with kills and things like that. And they're starting to use her in a little bit more areas than just kills, I know. You know, before she was kind of, I mean, she kind of took on a little bit of a Stephanie Farrell type role where it was just a lot of kills, a lot of things like that. Lately, she's been serving a lot better, you know, doing a lot of different things. But, yeah, Jakel, I mean, especially we talk about the 7-game win streak they're on right now. And for the last 14 games, really, she's been on absolute tear, double-digit kills in every game. Obviously, she gets way more swings than everybody else on the team. So she's getting a ton of opportunities to do things she's doing. And they even say, like, I mean, Mary Wise doesn't mind Christy getting errors as much as some of the players on the other team because she just wants her, you know, letting it rip and doing some of those different things. So, I mean, she's obviously a huge aspect of this offense right now.
Yeah, what I've seen from Jakel in the games that I've watched is that she's always spearheading any offensive run they have. A lot of times when the ball's set up, she's the one who's delivering. So, I mean, she's kind of their go-to player on offense. And, I mean, Christy.
All these Ks.
Man. Okay. So, but in terms of Christy, I mean, she's getting a lot of swings, obviously, as Brian said. And, you know, just from what I've seen, she's constantly, like, the one who's swinging. I haven't been able to see her play as of late because of my switch to Whoops. But from what I saw early on, she really is that key cog on offense in terms of kills and total attacks and such.
Now, another player at that position who's put up a lot of kills this year, and Holt, you touched on this briefly, Stephanie Farrell. She was really interesting to me because she kind of transferred in from Hawaii last year when I was covering the team last year. It was her first season with Florida, and she showed some flashes but was very inconsistent overall. How has she improved in her second year here?
Stephanie Farrell's picked up her consistency, you know, a considerable amount. That's one of the big things that they've talked about is her, you know, being a little better with her shot selection and, you know, knowing when to hit the ball as hard as she can and when to not. And that's something that, you know, it kind of comes and flows. Sometimes she's a lot more consistent. She has had games where she had, I think, you know, 500 and, you know, had a really good job with limiting the errors. But she still does have, you know, quite a few of the games where she just goes out there and just tries to kill absolutely everything as hard as she can and commit some errors. She still does that, has some low hitting percentage games. But, I mean, she is definitely one of these kind of intimidating front row players that kind of characterizes this Florida offense right now of just, I mean, you see them in games, and they look like they're hitting twice as hard as these opponents in some of these SEC games against lower-tier, you know, teams. And Stephanie Farrell is definitely one of the players that just absolutely destroys the ball and, you know, does a lot of really good things there.
Yeah, one of the things that will be key down the stretch, I think, is just Farrell's play. I mean, Mary described her play as streaky, like, at the beginning of the year. And, you know, active ankle challenge, MVP. But, like, I think the most prominent display of that streakiness was the LSU-Arkansas weekend. Against Arkansas, she hit like 050 for a hitting percentage, and it came out against LSU, and I think it was in the 400s or so. So, I mean, Farrell, when she's on, she's really good. But, I mean, as Brian said, with the hitting hard and such, she is prone to a lot of errors. So, I mean, if she gets on a run, that offense is going to keep rolling. But, I mean, when she goes cold, it's kind of hard for them to recover.
And there still is a sense that they kind of want to almost limit her role a little bit to where she just has to do one thing. I know, you know, she doesn't play as many rotations as someone might expect out of a player who is one of their starting and best outside hitters. She swaps off and, you know, switches and mixes up with Maddie Montserrat and some, you know, some freshmen and things like that. So they definitely, I think, want to limit her role just so she has one thing, you know, one or two things to focus on. And so she can just really hammer those things home.
Yeah, last year Mary said the reason she wasn't out there as much was things like serve reception and passing. Has she gotten any better in those areas, or is that still kind of a problem for her?
I mean, she has gotten a little better in those areas, but that's also one of the reasons why they pretty much sub her out when it's her rotation to go anywhere near the backcourt. So, I mean, I know they've talked about her improving in those areas, but I still don't know if there's the trust level there to actually use her in games. Because, I mean, pretty much any time it's time for her to go back and play more of a defensive role, we see Maddie Montserrat come in, and they literally split their rotations half and half, even though one of them is, you know, a very dynamic point scorer, and the other one is a totally different player, totally different, you know, kind of individual. So, yeah, I mean, there's still obviously some trust issues there probably with the other aspects of her game, but I think they've just come to the conclusion that they're not even going to tinker with those.
Yeah. Another player that transferred in last year, Tangerine Wiggs. She came in kind of like a stick figure, but apparently she's put on some muscle, and she's been having a pretty good year. What have you seen out of her so far?
She's still pretty stick figure. She's got some muscle on her, but no, Tangerine is, you know, I mean, she's another one that doesn't have too heavy of a job. They don't put too many roles on her and let, you know, kind of players like Kelly Murphy and stuff take on the more tasks while just giving her a very specific thing. But, you know, she's been good. She was early in the season, especially, she was very, very effective and was getting a lot of, I think she was getting a lot of chances while Chrissy Jacob was maybe getting less chances than she is right now. And she was taking, I mean, there were a couple weeks where she was really on a roll and, you know, doing a lot of really good things and stuff like that. And she does some good things on the block and, you know, with everything. But, I mean, she's been impressive. She's been a, you know, a steady kind of thing. She's taken on a little bit of a, you know, a leadership role. She's probably one of the more vocal people on the team. So, you know, there's been a lot of really good things out of Tangerine this year, especially I feel like earlier in the season she was getting more opportunities to show what she can do, but she's still, you know, contributing when it's time to right now.
Yeah, Brian mentioned the block. Tangerine, one of the things I've noticed from watching her, she is, like, really such a net presence. I feel like she's very good on the block, you know, like, as time goes on. You know, she's a junior this year, right? So yeah. Next year, her senior year, I feel like she can be, like, a real key part of that block at the net. I mean, I've seen her make several key, like, good blocking plays, especially against LSU, so.
She's one of the more intense players on the team, yeah, too. I know, you know, volleyball is such kind of like a happy-go-lucky sport and things like that. And she's one of the only people that, like, when things are going wrong, she's, like, legitimately pissed off. And that's, like, something you don't really get to see out of a lot of the players. It's almost kind of refreshing to see it, you know, out of somebody kind
of
get a little bit
instead
into
of just
it, like
the celebration every
yeah,
play.
Yeah.
Have a little downside, too.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit about the blocking. Another player who's big into that is Cassandra Anderson. She's been good her first 2 years here and apparently having another strong season. What has she brought to the table? And I know Mary Wise says blocking is something that's really important and just in volleyball.
Yeah, you know, Cassandra, they put a huge emphasis on her blocking and, you know, having that net presence that, you know, Tangerine's developing that Joe talked about. I know, you know, Joe did a story on Cassandra earlier in the year, and there's a lot of things about, you know, just how she's reading things, how she's seeing offenses this year, and they feel like she's doing a lot better. Maybe not physically, she's not showing that much of a difference, but mentally, and, you know, Mary talks about volleyball IQ all the time, and that's, you know, something I feel like maybe she's picking up on a little bit more this year, and, you know, just being smart with the blocks, not just focused on quantity, but focused on, you know, when they can, you know, make moves and make things happen in the game.
Yeah, I think with Cassandra earlier in the year that Wise was talking about, she wasn't really getting enough touches, which is took a hit on our numbers, but, I mean, Cassandra is one of the best blockers in the SEC, led the conference in it last year, and you know, with Cassandra, like, she's not as tall as your typical middle blocker. So, I mean, she kind of compensates for that size, too, which is a big deal. So, the fact that they didn't get the kind of play they do from her, considering her size, really is something that Florida values a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Another name that interests me is Taylor Unroad. Last year, she came in, and she was supposed to be another big part of the back row defense, but she got hurt and missed the whole season. Coming back this year, has she lived up to the expectations that she came in with?
You know, she's definitely been an improvement in the backcourt over, you know, from what we've heard about Aaron Fleming from last year and things like that. It's definitely been a learning experience for her. She came in and, you know, physically and everything else, libero's been a position she's played her entire life. So she has all the instincts of it, all the, you know, wanting to get to balls and things like that. A lot of times it's just been a matter of actually knowing what's going on. And then Mary talks a lot about getting the passing and, you know, starting off the offense and things like that as being things she needs to work on. Especially lately, you know, we keep going back to this kind of 7-game winning streak they're on and, you know, how hot they are right now. You know, a few weeks ago we were talking about Taylor not playing very well and not having her dig numbers where they need to be and, you know, had a few pretty poor games. And since then, you know, there was a week of practice where she stepped up and she was like, I'm going to raise my dig numbers. And she's done that ever since. So, I mean, she's had... I wrote it the other day, I think she'd had like 20-something more digs in the past 3 games than she had had in the 3 games before that.
Hmm.
And And it's not like this is a product of blocks going down. The blocks have been staying the same, and she's just been getting to more balls than she has been before and just knowing, you know, what to do with them. So Unruh has definitely been an improvement, especially lately, and it's kind of developing with her. You know, we're going to see where she is when they play the big games against Tennessee and Kentucky and, you know, going forward to the postseason.
Yeah, Unruh seems really mature from what I've seen from her. Like, I guess that has a lot to do with the redshirt years, kind of getting adjusted to the college game, maybe not having to be thrown into the fire. But from what I've seen, she has a good grasp of what she's supposed to do, and she understands her role. And when Mary talks about her, just like her eyes just kind of like light up or whatever. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading into something that isn't there, but it sounds good, so I'm gonna go with it.
You're very internal.
Yeah.
I'm very good at reading people. Yeah. When I read Mary Wise.
That's what you get.
I'm kind of scared.
I'm reading you right now, Holt.
That's not good, probably. But there was legitimately a stretch there, though, where we talked to Mary and talked to her about how Unruh was affecting, you know, the younger backcourt players who this is their very first year in the program, like Maddie and Holly. And, you know, there was a time when Mary said, well, Taylor doesn't really know what she's doing either. She's just running around a little bit more. And I think that's changed now. I think, you know, just over the last couple of weeks, she's really picked up a lot of things, whether it's watching film or doing other things, where she just seemed like she knows, like she has a purpose in what she's doing now. She's not just flying around trying to make random digs, so.
Right. And then the last name that I remember standing out last year that we have not touched on yet is Chanel Brown. In her second year at the center position, really, how's she been so far?
She's adjusted a lot more smoothly than she did. You know, as a freshman, coming in as a freshman, she was, you know, she was an outside hitter in high school, and setting was just being a setter was something she had to kind of get used to. And it's kind of, she's kind of a little bit of a tough role just because, you know, the other setter on the team is Kelly Murphy, who's Kelly right. Murphy. So, you know, it's tough for her kind of getting outshined in some of the numbers and things like that sometimes. But, you know, she does a very good job of what she's doing, obviously, with when Christy Jaeckel and all these players are putting up huge kill numbers, a lot of times it's because, you know, Chanel really knows what she's doing and getting things started in the front court. And she just, I mean, from everything I've talked to Coach Wise about, she's just a lot more comfortable in that spot this year than she was last year. And she had a good freshman year. So, right. You know, obviously good things going forward.
Yeah, with Chanel, one thing when I was covering volleyball was I look at the stat sheet at the end of the game and boom, there was like 20 assists there. And it's like, where did that come from? You know, just, I don't know, just the overshadowing of Kelly Murphy. You know, it's hard to be in that role. And I think Chanel plays it very well.
Yeah.
I'm going to put you guys on the spot a little bit here. With just a month or so left in the season, when do they wrap it up? When's the NCAA tournament?
It is in December, I believe, like the middle of the month it really wraps up.
A couple months left. How do you see this shaking out down the stretch? Where do the Gators finish in the SEC and then nationally? How do you see that? Where do you see them finishing in the tournament?
I think if they continue on the roll they're on right now, they're headed for another SEC championship.
There's no tournament championship, right?
No, there's not. It's just regular season. As far as the SEC, yeah, I mean, like next weekend, like I said, they're going to go to Kentucky and Tennessee. Tennessee is a team they probably shouldn't have lost to before, and that's probably their stiffest competition in the SEC right now. So, you know, I see them winning those games. I see them winning the SEC. As for the big picture, you know, I don't see much past, you know, 16 berth right now. As far as there's too many areas. They're a very senior-laden team in the front court, but it just seems like there's holes still with some of these young players that are going to be exposed a little bit when they go up against, you know, some top competition. Early in the season, they had, you know, the same problems. They played all these teams that they should beat, and they dominated them, but then when they played the Iowa States, you know, the Tennessees of the world,
Stanford.
Mm-hmm. You know, they were good games. They went five sets, but some of the things shined through and they lost those games, and now they're close games. So, you know, Mary and the players didn't put a huge emphasis on it. They said, you know, we're 2 points away from being undefeated and things like that. But, you know, it's still kind of – it's going to be a test because they're really not going to play anybody of those kind of top team calibers past maybe Kentucky and Tennessee up until the NCAA tournament. So it's not like we're going to learn that much about this team until they get to where it's single elimination. If they lose, they go home.
Right.
So
it's not having that kind of like SEC tournament where it is kind of one and done atmosphere. Do you think that hurts them to just jump straight from the regular season into the NCAA tournament?
I don't really think it does, just because I mean, the SEC is a very, you know, very, very top. It's a very top-heavy conference. I mean, it's not like there are that many good teams in it. And the good teams that there are, you know, Florida, Kentucky, Tennessee pretty much, I mean, they're up here and every other team is kind of down there. And so it's one of those things where even if one of those teams, you know, they get to the SEC tournament, it's like, I know I covered softball during the spring and Florida dominated the SEC all year in softball. So once they got to the tournament, they really could have cared less about it and just kind of dropped out to Auburn in the first game. And, you know, that I feel like that's what you kind of get out of this volleyball tournament. The conference just top to bottom isn't competitive enough to where, you know, a one and done tournament would really.
To where it even you know, mentality.
And they play, I mean, and they literally, Mary talks about it literally every time she talks. Is this is the only sport where there's a double round robin, where you play every team in your conference twice, home and away. So these teams have seen each other so much by the end of the year, it doesn't really seem necessary to throw them into a tournament.
All right, Joe Morgan, where do you see them finishing out the year?
Ooh, that's tough, because I haven't seen the...
I haven't seen the product the last week or so?
Yeah, but...
Based on what you know, just give me a guess.
Based on what I know, I think they're probably going to end up winning the SEC. That Tennessee game, I remember watching that, and there was just Florida's undone a lot by their own errors. They see Florida, one of the main problems they have in these close games is I feel like they just tend to drift into these service errors. I don't know if I'm just, you know, noticing.
No, making more stuff
yeah,
up.
Yeah.
But, you know what?
The Tennessee game especially, there were a ton of service errors in the fifth set.
Mm-hmm.
I heard about them.
So I'm going to go Elite Eight, just the one-up
hole
here.
All right. We'll see how it works out.
Yeah, but...
Joe Morgan's a glass half full kind of guy.
Is there anything else you guys want to touch on the volleyball front before we get you out of here?
Just Maddie Monster, a definition of scrappy.
Maddie Monster, if you look up scrappy in the dictionary, there's a little blonde girl named Maddie Monster right there.
And she's a defensive specialist?
She's a defensive specialist. This is her first year here from Orlando. She actually played at OVA, which is the club team that Callie Rivers played for, Aaron Fleming played for. You know, a lot of history
Former
there.
Former Gator greats.
Yeah. A lot of history there between the Gators and OVA. And she's a player they've been really impressed with so far. You know, it's kind of a tough – it's going to be weird to see this role that she's coming in because she is only a year behind Unruh, and they're kind of gunning for the same position. Right now, Unruh has the upper hand because she came in as a huge recruit and she had a year to watch, you know, while she had that foot injury. And but Monster is a player who's really been impressive. She takes – I mean – the thing about her is she's willing to take on this role so that it also helps, you know, Stephanie Farrell. Stephanie Farrell wouldn't be anything like the player she is if she had to play all six rotations. I mean, that right. just wouldn't, you know, you just wouldn't see it. So I think she's kind of quietly been one of the, you know, more kind of impact type players on this team and just really done a lot of nice things.
All right, well, then I guess that about wraps up the volleyball coverage. Joe Morgan's sticking around for some women's hoops talk, but Holt, we're going to let you get out of here. So
I'm
going to
go on that couch and take a nap.
He's going to chill out on the podcast studio and take a nap, so you might hear him snoring in the background.
It's not a big deal. I sleep talk sometimes.
All right, so like I said, we're going to shift over to Whoops conversation right now. For a long time, the women's basketball program has kind of been the weak link of the Florida athletic system. Joe Morgan, do you have any reason to believe that they can kind of turn it around this year from what you know about the team so far?
Well, it's interesting. You look at last season, they had 20 wins while incorporating six new players into the lineup and switching to an up-tempo style. So last year, kind of chaotic. So the 20 wins seems like an accomplishment.
Right. I mean, in perspective.
Yeah. You also have to look at the double-digit blown leads in the second half. They had five of those last year. I wrote a story on that earlier this week. And, I mean, if they can finish... off those games this year, which I feel like they can since they're more used to each other, then I don't know. I mean, it's completely a possibility that they could come back to the NCAA tournament.
All right. You mentioned kind of the up-tempo style. Is that something they're sticking with this year? They're going to play fast?
From what I got from Coach Butler, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. The offense is led by now sophomore point guard Jatira Bonds, made the All-SEC freshman team last year. Averaged about 10 points, 2.5 dimes a game last year.
Which is team-leading 10 points.
Second.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Well, either way, that's about the team lead because they had a couple players who scored about even from what I'm looking
at. Yeah, like the top scores are very even. Like I think they had like five players ranging from 7 to 10.
Right, yeah. I see Jordan Jones at 10.2 and Jatira Bonds at 9.9. So yeah. Morgan's right on that one. But actually, yeah, talk a little bit about – because Jatira Bonds came off the bench a lot last year if I was looking at this right. She was kind of a spark plug player in that way.
Yeah, she played 34 games, started 13 of them. And, I mean, she just provided the spark, and, like, the league coaches were obviously impressed by that. But she just seems – I mean, I watched some of the practice yesterday, and Tierra just seems really spunky out there. So
Now, they did lose a player, didn't they, to transfer before the season started?
Yeah, DeAndre Young transferred, announced her transfer. She doesn't know where she's going yet. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where she's going yet as of now. But she had, like, a foot injury late last year and missed, like, the last 9 games or so.
So did she have any kind of major impact or role on the team last season?
Not really. Four points, 4 rebounds per game.
Okay.
I mean, replaceable numbers.
Right. Looking at the players who did kind of put up some stats last year, we have Jordan Jones as the leading scorer we touched on briefly. What does she bring to the table?
Well, from what I get talking to the team, Jordan Jones is obviously the team leader. I mean, she talks a lot. In terms of team leadership, she just seems to be that go-to person. She talks to me a lot about how she's looking for certain players to contribute this year. Jennifer George is one of them, junior forward. She really is the face of this team in terms of leadership.
She's a senior this year, experienced player.
That's right. She's one of 5 seniors this year.
So they bring back pretty much every significant player that they had last year. And kind of looking down the stat sheet, there's a lot of players, like you said, who scored in that 4 to 10 point range. And a lot of guards there. So, I mean, to the naked eye, I guess depth is the strength of this team, right?
Yeah, definitely the guard position. That kind of fits with the up-tempo style. Just a lot of them flying around and stuff. They talk about working on passes and stuff. They're going to be a really quickly moving team, I believe, this year.
All right. And then kind of looking inside a little bit, names that stand out to me, Jennifer George you touched about, and then Azania Stewart is a name that I recall for a while. She was a leading rebounder last year. Just talk about those two, what you know about them and their play.
Yeah, I spoke with Azania and Jennifer at practice yesterday, and Azania, also another team leader, seems, you know, she has her head on straight and everything. And going to Jennifer, though, I mean, Jennifer is a really talented player who hasn't really played to her full potential yet. Players talked about how Jennifer kind of has to get angry to go on the spurt. So, Jatira said the last
year. You don't want to see Jennifer when she's angry.
Oh, segue into something else in a minute. Jatira said that last year at one point they actually slapped her in the face to kind of get her amped up.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just all kind of weird
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
Leaking out about this team.
They probably won't slap her a lot this year, Jatira said. But
you would hope not.
Yeah. But when Jennifer gets angry, her teammates said that she really comes alive. Jordan said that a lot over the summer, Jennifer became a lot more assertive. Jordan said there were certain instances during the summer, there'd be plays. Jennifer would come off the court and say, hey, I was open there, which was something that they hadn't seen from her in the past. So maybe Jennifer's ready to be more of a demanding post player this year.
When you look at kind of the balance of the team, is it more of a, is there strength inside or is the strength outside? Where's their best area?
The strength's outside. They were a really heavy 3-point shooting team last year, and I think that's going to be kind of the tone this year as well. You have Azania and Jennifer down low, but based off their past performance, they don't seem like they're going to be dominant types. So you're going to continue to have that outside reliance, I think.
And one thing that came with kind of being an outside team last year, too, is there was a lot of turnovers that were a problem for this team, if I remember right. Is there anything they told you about kind of getting that corrected or kind of improving in that area?
Well, one thing Butler says is she says that she's such a fan of aggressive play that she's willing to forgive mistakes if they come on really aggressive plays. But yeah, I talked to the team about the turnovers, and they said that they're working on passing the ball like better, and that a lot of it's just learning each other's tendencies. They attributed a lot of the turnover problems with just inexperience with each other last year. You had like the 2 or 3 transfers coming in, a lot of new freshmen, so just things of that nature.
Now, with all the experience they have and all the seniors, are they trying to challenge themselves at all in their non-conference schedule a little bit this year?
The non-conference schedule is interesting. I mean, you have a couple big players in Michigan and Florida State, and you have actually Charlotte, Coach Butler's former school that knocked Florida out of the NIT last year. But at the same time, you have Maine, Duquesne, Charleston Southern.
Which sound like kind of softies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's definitely an interesting non-conference slate from that kind of jumping from Michigan to a San Francisco type thing. So,
where did they finish last year kind of in the scheme of things in the SEC, and how do you see that kind of shaking out this year?
Well, they were 7-9 in conference play last year, and they were better than that record, to be honest. I mean, they blew some pretty major leads against Kentucky, Alabama, I know. They actually had Tennessee pretty close play in the first half of their
they
SEC.
They had some massive losses.
Yeah. Yeah, Tennessee really made an example out of them.
30-40 point blowout.
Yeah. But, of course, Tennessee does that to a lot of people, though. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, they – I mean, going into, like, late season last year, they seemed to really be hitting their stride in that Charlotte game, just another double-digit blown lead. But SEC, they were kind of middle of the road last year, 7-9 conference record. They were middle of the road in terms of, like, points per game, points allowed per game. And I think just things like experience will help out with that.
Because it's one thing to be a young team and mm-hmm. then kind of bring everybody back and get better. But it's another thing to actually, like, when you bring all those players back to make a significant mm-hmm. improvement. Is there reason to believe, like, the same group of people that lost to Tennessee by 40 last year could actually kind of make a move on them this year? Or is it just kind of going to be more the same, most likely?
I'm thinking more of the same. I mean, Coach Butler was talking a lot about not talking about last year. And it's like, well, I mean, there's some pretty pressing concerns last year that
right.
they haven't really addressed. I mean, one thing that they have addressed is endurance and new strength and conditioning coordinator Rich Jacobs really made an impression on a lot of the players. Wrote about that last week, but overall, I don't really see much cause for. I mean, they could make the tournament. Like, I'm not going to completely rule it out, but I'm thinking probably more of the same.
But they're still, even if they make the tournament, it kind of sounds like they're going to be like on the cusp, kind of be mm-hmm. a bubble team, and that's not. It doesn't really sound like that's where they need to be as far as a program right now.
Right. I mean, this is Butler's fifth year. They only made the tournament once. And, I mean, I think that's just the state of Florida women's basketball right now. You're just on the bubble, and you hope yeah. you end up on the right side of it every year.
Now, when you talk about Amanda Butler, our usual podcast guest, Matt Watts, was not a huge fan of Amanda Butler and wrote a lengthy feature in the spring kind of talking about how she's kind of underperformed expectations since she's been at Florida and maybe some of the things that she's done wrong and kind of her attitude and, like, punching a whiteboard and kind of mm-hmm. intimidating people. And they've had a lot of transfers who some of them have said it's kind of in connection to the way she acted. What are your first impressions of dealing with her from what you've seen so far?
Well, I don't know Amanda very well yet. I mean, she's been pleasant to me. She didn't remember my name, but like, I didn't expect her to. So.
Happens.
Start wearing a name tag, but... I mean, Amanda seemed to have a good rapport with the players at practice, the one practice I went to yesterday. So, I mean, so far, so good. I mean, I'm not going to make a judgment on
right.
that.
Right. It's something to keep an eye on as the
yeah,
year goes
I'll
on.
Yeah, I'll definitely be keeping a close eye on that. So.
All right. Is there anything else you want to make sure we touch on before we get you out of here and wrap up the Whoop section?
No, just the season starts on November 11th. Home game, so.
And then that goes all the way through to about the same time the men's does, right? The tournaments are mm-hmm. around the same time?
That's right.
All right, so get out there and watch your Whoops. Keep an eye out for that. Whoops. Joe, thanks for coming in today.
No problem.
Okay, we're going to switch over and talk a little swimming. Maybe for the first time ever on the podcast. I'm not sure. It probably doesn't get a whole lot of airtime, but we're going to welcome in Alex Peckham. He's our swimming writer for this semester. So, Alex, how's it going?
Pretty good.
All right, so just start us off. Tell me a little bit about the team, maybe where they're headed this year, how their year's been going so far.
Well, the team is... The women's team is ranked 7th in the nation, or end of the season ranked 7th in the nation, so they sort of carry over that ranking. But things are looking bright on that side. The top swimmers are sophomore Elizabeth Beisel and then two seniors, Teresa Crippen and Sarah Bateman, all of whom have Olympic hopes. Elizabeth Beisel competed in the Beijing Olympics in 2008 and actually placed 4th in an event, so...
That's the big story around the team this year, right? The Olympic stuff, how that's
the Olympics, especially because head coach Greg Troy is going to be the coach of the men's Olympic team in London this year. So it's an exciting time around the pool in the O'Connell Center because a lot of the men's Olympians are coming to train, so they get to rub shoulders with some of the Gator swimmers and maybe learn a bit from those guys.
Are there some of the men on the Gators men's team that have a shot to make the Olympics this summer?
The men's team is really young, so they're sort of not sure what to expect, especially in terms of international aspirations. But the women's side definitely has a lot of strong swimmers. So obviously Ryan Lochte will be competing in the Olympics, and a lot's expected of him this time around. So.
Yeah, former Gator Ryan Lochte. I've been hearing some stuff. Have you been following that level of it at all? Because I've been hearing things where, like, people are telling me he's, like, on Michael Phelps level now.
There's a lot of talk about that. Because Michael Phelps Ryan Lochte has actually beaten him head-to-head in competition a few times since the Beijing Olympics, where obviously Phelps had a historic run there. But Lochte's actually been the better one in competition since then, but he just needs to prove that on the Olympic stage.
Anyway, back to the current Gators a little bit. They lost Brett Frazier and Connor Dwyer last year, so the men's side, I'm guessing, is really young. Are there any guys that have stood out so far, though? Any like young freshmen that are going to be here for a while?
Coach Troy coming in the season was very excited about his 12-man freshman class. Matt Elliott, who, after the All-Florida Invitational 2 weeks ago, was named the SEC Freshman of the Week. He won three events in that competition. And other freshmen that have competed well so far include Matthew Kirby, Carlos Omana, and Eduardo Solacci. So even though it's a young team, there's definitely they definitely have a lot of chances to make some noise in NCAAs and SEC championships.
All right, so when is the NCAAAs and SEC start?
The NCAAs is in late March, and the SEC is just a little before that.
So they're still in, are they already in kind of team play right now? Because I know with tennis, they do a lot of individual stuff, and then they get into team stuff. Is that how it is with swimming? Or?
No, they sort of go right off the bat with the team stuff. That the team has, or the men's and women's team have both competed against LSU, and then the women's team is currently on a road trip. They competed at Arkansas on Thursday night, and they will be in a select group of eight female swimmers will be swimming in the Dallas Classic against an elite field of six teams at SMU on Friday and Saturday night.
All right, so they're already getting started, and that's just going to carry through. Is there any worry that kind of the Olympics and all that stuff is going to overshadow what's going on with the team and the SEC and all these things that seem so trivial in comparison?
That's definitely been an issue, especially with Coach Troy having to divert some of his time to his Olympic duties. But he's really been confident that the swimmers in particular can really separate the two things. There are going to be some conflicts later in the season, especially around NCAA time, when the coaches are going to have to make some decisions about how to send certain swimmers to like USA trials and the NCAA meet, how to sort of divide the time.
All that stuff kind of overlaps. That's a little
it's all sort of happening at the same time. So there's definitely going to be some tough decisions to be made there.
All right. Is Troy expected to be working with like the other Olympic swimmers right now? Is it like taken away from his time at the school? Or?
He's talked about that. He says that most of his time will still be dedicated to Florida swimming, but he's also confident in his staff that he's assembled, who include Donnie Crane and Anthony Nesty in particular, who are Anthony Nesty was a former swimmer here in Gainesville.
Is Wilby still an assistant coach?
Yes, Martin Wilby still
and they're,
is.
They're all, not to cut in, but they're kind of his lieutenants, but they're also doing Olympic stuff as well, right?
Yeah, they're working the Olympic team also.
So it's
definitely
other countries too, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Wilby's doing the Cayman Islands, which is Brett Frazier, him and his brother. That's who they're going to be swimming for. So it's like even though they're going to have, he has these two experienced lieutenants, everybody's all in for the Olympics, it seems like, this year.
All right. Well, I guess you are new to the beat, but do you have an idea, kind of based on what you know about the team so far, where they stack up in terms of the SEC and nationally, both men's and women's, kind of where they fit into the whole picture there?
It's hard to tell so far, but the results have been strong. LSU has been an up-and-coming team. They finished last season ranked 20th in the nation, and both Florida teams handled them pretty well last week, and then the women's team had a pretty commanding victory over Arkansas yesterday. So Florida's always expected to be near the top of the SEC, and this year doesn't seem like it's any different. There's more question marks on the men's side, but they appear to be strong also.
Yeah, you said the women are number 7, right?
Yes.
And then where are the men ranked?
The men finished last year ranked number 5. Based on the result at the NCAA tournament. The official rankings for this year have not come out yet.
Right, and that's probably going to drop quite a bit because they got a lot of young people.
Yeah, it probably will.
Right.
Ha- has there been any diving this semester whatsoever? It kind of seems, when you go look at the results online and stuff like that, you're not seeing a lot of diving happening at these meets.
Yeah, it hasn't. It's just starting to be in the programs for these events. There was diving at the LSU meet, and then last night in Arkansas. And Coach Troy has been pleased with all the diving results so far. That appears to be a strength of both teams.
All right, so we got a young men's team, a experienced women's team, a lot of Olympic stuff going on. But we thank you for coming in today and kind of clearing it all up for us.
Thank you for having
swimming
me.
Insight. Okay, so that wraps up the guest portion of the show. Now Booth and I are going to kind of round it out and kind of finish everything off the other sports we haven't gotten to yet. We'll start with cross country. Booth, you were the cross country guy last year. What do you got for us on that? How they've been doing?
Yeah, they had a strong start to the season this year. I mean, the men's team won their first two meets. The women's team won their first as well. Both started in the low and high 20s as far as their rankings. Had a little bit of a good vibe behind them, but they really fell off in their last meet. Wisconsin Adidas Invitational. I believe there was 39 men's teams and 42 women's teams at the meet. And it was really a chance for them to make a statement after they lost some key runners from last year's team. Of course, the men's team lost to Masani Halasalo.
He was the best player by far, right?
He was one of the best men's runners to come to Florida in maybe the last 5 years. I mean, he was utterly dominant, and he was on his way to being, you know, a nationally contended kind of guy. But, of course, he had a run-in with the law. He was charged with sexual assault the night after in an incident the night after the NCAA championship for track. So, yeah, he's in the Gainesville jail right now. He's off the team, away from the program. They're not involved with him whatsoever anymore. And then on the women's side, they lost Charlotte Browning, who was an English runner, who was a transfer from Arizona State a couple years ago, and she had a very good career at Florida to wrap up her final 2 years. Helped them win an SEC championship last year. So of course they lost her. Both teams lost their two dominant runners, so to speak. But heading into this year, there was a lot of reason to think that they could, you know, at least progress or stay to where they are, but it didn't really look like it at the Wisconsin meet. I mean, they had a lot of different teams that they were going up against. It was a loaded field. Wisconsin's men, they're just about the best in the nation right now, and conversely on the women's side. And they both, I believe the women's team finished in 19th at the meet, and the men's finished in 32nd. They both finished 7th last year in a little less talented field. But then again, only two runners on either side finished in the top 50. So it was a poor showing, a real disappointment. And heading into the SEC slate, you know, a runner like Genevieve Lacaze, who's an Australian runner, has been around here for a while. She broke the record in the women's steeplechase during the track season. So you figure some of that would carry over into this. And it really hasn't. As far as her performance in the Wisconsin meet, she really hasn't lived up to kind of the expectation that she set during that season. Mm. And on the men's team, it's a bunch of role guys right now. They don't have the one dominant runner who's out there, who everybody's maybe trying to pace and protect out there on the field. They don't have that guy. It's just a bunch of guys are around the same ability and nobody you can really challenge to win an overall race. So it doesn't really look like they're going to challenge to try to break their streak of being out of the NCAA tournament or NCAA race, I should say, at the end of the year. The women's team, though, they might have a chance. I mean, there's Vanderbilt, who's number 3 in the nation right now, and Arkansas is number 14. Florida is currently out of the rankings. I mean, by the end of the year, if Genevieve gets it together and their transfer, Florence Nagetich, who's a Kenyan runner, if she's able to come on and kind of adjust to the cross-country style, who knows? Maybe they can get something going before the SEC race. But as of right now, it doesn't look too promising for either team, and they're really going to need a big performance in a couple weeks at the – I believe it's October 31st, which is – the meet falls on a Monday this year, which is a little awkward.
I like that, Booth. Very thorough. Very thorough in your cross-country coverage. Kind of moving over to men's tennis a little bit, because a lot of the stuff you said there reminds me of that, because they lost their top guy. They lost Alexander Lacroix. He's the winningest tennis player in Florida history.
Yeah.
He won a lot of matches, both singles and doubles, while he was here, and they don't have exactly a top-flight guy to replace him. Probably the best player on the team right now in terms of the rankings is Nassim Salam. He's number 37. They also have Bob Van Overbeek, number 58, number 69, Frank Carleton, and number 119, Billy Federhofer. So, not as highly ranked as some of the Florida tennis teams we've seen in the past. Basically, the way tennis works, for those of you who have never followed it, is the fall season is a lot of individual tournaments and stuff like that before team play actually starts up in the spring. So, all they've really done right now is there was the ITA All-American Championships. Salam was the only one that qualified, and he lost in the first round. And then they host this thing called the Gator Invitational, where they kind of have like UCF and USF and those kind of teams come in. And they went 18-0 at that meet there. So it'll be interesting to see how it works out for men's tennis, because they definitely don't have the kind of talent base they've had. But we'll see what they can get done. One team that definitely does have as strong of a talent base as anybody is the women's side. Defending national champion women's tennis team, and it's easy to see why when you just look at the roster.
And they really haven't lost anything either. Right. So
you got number 2 Allie Will in terms of national rank, number 5 Lauren Embry, number 26 Joanna Mather, number 34 Alex Zirconi, then number 73 Sophie Oyen, and number 85 Caroline Hitimana. And it's hard to have teams that go that deep and still have people
all in the top 100. Yeah, especially. I mean, you really don't see that too much. I mean, maybe a Stanford or something like that would have it through the top 4. But Florida, they look loaded right now.
Yeah, and then that even continued in the fall season when Allie Will won the ITA All-American Singles title, which is actually a very big deal. It's one of the 4 collegiate Grand Slams, so that's a real strong performance from her. And then at that same event, Lauren Embry and Joanna Mather won the doubles title. So the women's tennis team really making a lot of noise, and I guess they would have a strong chance to repeat next year.
There's been no drop-off. It seems like there's no lull from you know, going through the grind of the NCAA championship and then doing their singles play in that, which they both slipped up a little bit after that, you know, kind of historic game almost, if you can call it that. Which it really was the comeback by Embry. You know, they were just so tired and exhausted from that. So maybe you would have expected coming into this fall season, maybe they're still just trying to, you know, get back into the swing of things, get back in the groove, but it really doesn't seem like they've missed a beat.
Yeah, a lot of credit for that has to go to. We got to make sure we get his name in here. Coach Roland Thornquist, he's done a great job with this team. So a lot of props to Roland on that one. Moving over to golf a little bit. Right now, the men are ranked number 38th. They've had 3 events so far this year. They finished 7 out of 15, 7 out of 11, and then they won the Bake at Ocean Course, where they were first out of the 12 teams there. So, I mean, the first couple games, not great, but that was a solid result there at the end for them. Best player right now is TJ Vogel. He's number 14 nationally, and he leads the team with a 71.2 average. You know anything about him, Mr. Brown?
Yeah, he's a transfer from USC, Southern California. And, yeah, he's really come right into the team and kind of taking that leadership role. I don't know if you can really talk about a leadership role in golf, but as far as their top player, their top gun, who they're gonna send out there, it really seems like he hasn't struggled with any kind of transition playing for Buddy Alexander this year.
Yeah, and then we got the next, because you mentioned him as like a leader, kind of the go-to guy, as much as that exists in golf.
Because yeah.
The next ranked player on the team is number 85, Tyler McCumber, and he's right behind Vogel with a 71.7 average, but at least the rankings indicate that he's not as good of a player, and there's certainly a drop-off after number 1. Other names to know on the golf front are Tommy Moe and J.D. Tomlinson, so if you're a golf fan, we don't have a whole lot for you just yet. The season's still pretty young, but those are some names to be on the lookout for. On the other side of the golf front, the women are number 10 ranked, so they're looking pretty good so far. They finished 13th at the Mason Rudolph Fall Preview. Then they finished 3rd at the Cougar Classic, presented by Piggly Wiggly.
Yeah, you got to get that in there.
Which is fun.
The plug for Piggly Wiggly.
Their top player is Camilla Hedberg. She's number 15 nationally. She's tied for 3rd in terms of individuals at that Cougar Classic. She finished tied for 3rd. And she shot the lowest total in school history at that event, so I mean, some promise for both golf teams. A little bit not as dominant as women's tennis, but all of those sports have some things going on, and they're certainly not Not disappointing by any means.
And the women's golf team, they haven't been able to compete as much as the tennis teams, it sounds like. I think they're coming off almost a month off from the Mason Rudolph. This weekend they're playing a little bit tougher tournament, some ranked teams, it sounds like. So we'll get a better feel of, I think, of where they are at the moment.
All right. Well, I'm exhausted.
Yeah,
we've been through a lot of small sports here today. We covered
golf, it was worth it. Tennis. It was fun. I think it needed to be said.
Yeah, volleyball, soccer, whoops. Yeah, no more listener emails. We don't do enough small sports. We've been all the small sports. But if you have any comments on the show, be sure to send feedback to podcast@alligator.org. If there was a certain sport that interested you, something you want us to talk about a little bit more, we can get that guy back in here and we can do a little more coverage on that. We'll try to cycle any or all of those guys back in here as we go along, just because. As strange as it seems, there's only like a month and a half left in football season before we start thinking about a bowl game, and then that's all over. So basketball's going to start up, so we'll have Booth in here quite a bit. So we're going to have a lot of interesting things going on in podcast land. Like I said, feedback to podcast@alligator.org. You can follow us on Twitter @alligatorsports. You can follow me on Twitter @GregLuca. Booth, where are you on Twitter?
I'm @JJBooth, but I don't really tweet that much. I don't really have anything insightful to say on there, or
just
witty.
Put all the
so
small sports alerts out there.
I should, yeah. That's where it should be. From now on, all small sports updates will be on JJ Booth.
There you go. You can keep an eye out for him once basketball season starts up. You can also you can like our podcast on Facebook @facebook.com/alligatorpodcast. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can do all the things I tell you about every week, and I probably miss at least one each time we go around. But that's the wrap up for now. I think we are going to come back on Tuesday. A little bit of a recruiting podcast for you. I know that's a favorite, and that's something to talk about on the bye week, especially with the football team not looking so great. Maybe give some people some things to look forward to in the future. So we'll be back with that on Tuesday, and then we will have our Georgia preview on Friday. Hopefully get Cody and Tyler back in here. So until then, thanks for listening. I mean, grind.